Lawrence didn't say anything. Lawrence's dad pulled them out of the school driveway, jerking the wheel so hard he nearly took out the flagpole. People jeered from the parade ground, or maybe that was another drill. The driveway turned into a gravel road through a gray forest. Lawrence's parents talked about the scandal of Patricia's disappearance and her assault on Mr. Rose, who had also gone missing now. By the time the car was pulling off the country road and onto the highway, Lawrence had fallen asleep in the back seat, listening to his parents freak out. Book 3. Chapter 16. Other cities had gargoyles or statues watching over them. San Francisco had scare owls. They stood guard along the city's rooftops, hunched over bright, ornate designs that were washed out by waves of fog. These wooden creatures bore witness to every crime and act of charity on the streets without changing their somber expressions. Their original purpose of frightening pigeons had ended in failure, but they still managed to startle the occasional human. Mostly, they were a friendly presence in the night. This particular evening, a giant yellow moon crested over a clear, warm sky. So every fixture, the owls included, was floodlit like a carnival on its last night in town, and moon-drunk roars came from every corner. A perfect night to go out and make some dirty magic. Magellan Jones wrote epic poems in which Greek gods talked like 1920s gangsters. The gimmick had worn thin a decade ago, but by then he'd become a fixture at the North Beach Cafe, where all the disappointed poets nursed their demitasses of espresso grounds. Magellan held his 50th birthday party at that cafe, and he must have said the wrong thing. At last, a wisecrack too sharp, because Dolly plunged the cake knife into Magellan's chest, all the way up to the handle. His only friend, the only one who'd put up with his shit all along. She missed his heart, but she broke his heart. He could feel the dirty knife all the way inside him, the buttercream frosting too sugary for any bacteria to resist. And of course, every last bug was antibiotic resistant nowadays. Magellan's trademark Kangol hat whirled underfoot as he swayed, dying on his feet because he was a poet. Damn it. Dolly cried and shook until her rainbow hair extensions fell out. Someone called an ambulance, but they shouldn't have wasted their... A woman touched Magellan's forehead and whispered that she liked his poetry, mentioning one poem by title, while she slid the knife all the way out. His fatal wound became a minor laceration as the knife withdrew. He opened his eyes to see who had done this, but the woman was already gone. Magellan fell to his knees at last, and Dolly wept on his shoulder until he took her face in his hands and said he forgave her and he was sorry. Jake dug through the lesions on his arms, trying to find a pristine spot along a vein, when he looked up to see a woman's hand suspending a $10 bill over his box lid. "I'm worried about you, Jake," the woman said, though he couldn't see her face. "You seem worse than last week. Listen, if I give you $10, will you swear never to do recreational drugs again?" He said yes and took the money. He soon discovered that hypodermic needles broke against his skin every single time. Jake could still carve his skin with knives or nails, but even then, the needle would snap against his vein, He was getting the frozen sweats already. Phyllis and Zuleika skipped down the street in Hayes Valley, talking soberly about the global economic crisis, the ocean rising faster than anyone had predicted ever since the Chukchi disaster, and the links between malnutrition and the new pandemics, but also singing silly girl trash songs and laughing too loud because they were young, crazy in love, and about to be meaningfully naked together in Zuleika's bed. They didn't even notice a big man in a trench coat, smelling of chewing tobacco, coming up behind them with a military-grade neural decapacitator, until he swung it and got first one, then the other, in the neck, pacifying them. They were down on the sidewalk, eyes rolling up and mouths spouting drool, as the man reached for his zip ties. Then the man heard a voice at his ear as he bent over the two prone women. Someone was right behind him, looking over his shoulder. A woman, all in black, with sharp green eyes. "You're about to get caught," she whispered. "They're coming for you." He pulled back, suddenly breathless. Sure enough, sirens rang in the distance. "If I let you forget this happened, what else will you forget?" she asked. The shaggy-haired man had tears in his eyes and a tremor in his free hand. "Anything," he said. "Whatever. Anything." "Then run," she commanded. "Run and forget." He ran, limbs flailing, head whipping with his own panicked galloping strides. By the time he was a block down the street, he'd forgotten his own name. A few more blocks, where he lived and where he came from. The farther he ran, the less he remembered. But he couldn't stop running. Francis and Carrie were screwed. Their lives were over, and you could hear their cries of despair from the street outside the UFO-shaped house. This was supposed to be the geek party to end all geek parties, where the A-listers met the thought leaders, and visionary investors would super collide with the best and brightest. Every detail was meticulous, from the three DJs to the fountain of exotic liquor to the organic slow food hors d'oeuvres. They were even able to host it at Rod Birch's place in Twin Peaks, with the living room that converted to a planetarium where the constellations changed shape to reflect the mood of the crowd. But everything had gone to shit. The DJs had launched a turf war, and the mashup DJ was trying to colonize the dub thrash DJ's set with some kind of meta mashup. The caddy engineers had gotten into a fistfight with the open-source Artichoke BSD developers on the balcony. Everybody felt guilty about drinking soju after what happened in Korea. The A-listers didn't show up, and somehow the party invite on Miu had gotten cluttered with wannabes, bloggers, and local nutcases. The slow food hors d'oeuvres made everybody sick to their stomachs, and soon there was an endless line to throw up in the hyperbaric bathroom. The dub thrash DJ won the DJ war and proceeded to make everybody's eardrums bleed with the most dreary shit imaginable. The smoke machine belched horrible candy floss-scented smog while the lights lurched into epilepsy-inducing configurations. The line to vomit in the bathroom was starting to resemble that famous photo of the bedraggled masses evacuating Seoul on foot. The constellations on the ceiling became a supermassive black hole, a Sagittarius A of party foulness. This was the worst disaster in human history. Just when Francis and Carrie resigned themselves to changing their names and leaving town, that weird girl showed up. The girl whom nobody would cop to having added to the party invite. The hippie who, Carrie had heard, let birds nest in her hair and rats live in her purse. Paula? Petra? No, Patricia. There had been a time, a happier, more innocent time, When Francis and Carrie had believed that Patricia showing up would be the worst thing that could happen to their party. "Sorry I'm late," she told Carrie, slipping out of her shoes as she strode into the front room. "I had to run some errands across town." As Patricia walked into the party room, the fugly smoke parted and the lights swung together, so her Betty Page hair had a halo and her wide face was lit by a floodlight aurora. She seemed to float into the room, barefoot in a small strappy black dress that left her pale shoulders mostly exposed. Her necklace had a heart stone that caught the arc lights and refracted pink sparkles. She walked through the party, saying hi or introducing herself, and everybody she touched felt the nausea and ill feeling pass away, as if she'd painlessly drawn some poison out of them. She wandered past the DJ and whispered in his ear, and moments later, the awful, crunging dub-thrash music was replaced by soothing dubstep. People swayed, happily. The wailing and lamentation became the hum of conversation. The bathroom had no line. People started hanging out on the balcony for reasons other than punching each other or throwing up in the bushes. Everybody agreed that Patricia had salvaged the party at the UFO house somehow, but nobody could have said how. She'd just kind of shown up, and the vibe had improved. Carrie found herself making Patricia a thank-you cocktail, holding it out in both hands, like an offering. Patricia hadn't needed much magic to rescue this awful party from the brink. Fixing an upset stomach was second nature to her. After some of the dorm room cooking at El Tisley May's, and the partygoers did most of the heavy lifting themselves once she redirected their energies a bit. But just like with the poet in North Beach and the junkie in the Tenderloin, the most important thing wasn't to let anybody see her doing magic. She'd been indoctrinated never to share her big, powerful secret with anyone. But she needed no reminder in any case. She still remembered her friend in middle school whom she'd done magic in front of, how he'd lost his shit and run away, and stopped talking to her right when she needed him. When she told herself that story nowadays, or shared it with others, she boiled it down to, "I showed my magic to a civilian one time, and it got ugly." Other than that, she hadn't thought about that kid in years. He'd been reduced to a single cautionary anecdote in her head. But she found herself thinking about him now, maybe because she was surrounded by geeks, or because pulling this shindig back from the party abyss with her bare hands was reminding her of how weird social interactions could be here in the real world. Especially after so many years in the bubble of El Tisley May's. And somehow, the image popped into her head of the boy, naked in a closet with bruises all over and blood caked around his nostrils. The last time she'd seen him. She found herself hoping he'd turned out okay after all. And then, as she finished her loop around the party, he was standing right in front of her. Almost, but not quite. Like magic. Patricia recognized Lawrence right off the bat. The sandy hair was the same, cut into a messy part instead of a fringe. He was a lot taller and a tad stockier. His eyes were the same hazel gray, and his chin still jutted, and he still looked kind of perplexed and a little pissed off about everything. But that could be because he was one of the people she hadn't yet healed. She did that now. He was wearing a collarless black button-up shirt with a small tiger embroidered on it, and black canvas pants. "You feeling okay?" she said. "Yeah," he said, straightening up. He half-smiled and rolled his neck like an owl. "Yeah, thanks. Starting to feel better. There's something weird about those hors d'oeuvres." "Yeah." He didn't recognize her, which made sense. It had been 10 years, and a lot had probably happened. Patricia should just keep moving through the party. Just move along. Don't try to have some kind of bullshit, uncomfortable reunion. But she couldn't help herself. Lawrence?
Yeah.
He shrugged, and then his eyes grew.
Patricia?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. It's good to, see you again. How've you been?
I've been good. How are you doing?
I'm good, too.
Long pause. Lawrence shuffled and needed a square napkin.
So, you violate any laws of physics lately?
Ha ha. No, not really. Patricia needed to get out of this conversation before it crushed the life out of her. Anyway, good running into you again.
Yeah. Lawrence looked around. I should introduce you to my girlfriend, Serafina. She was here a second ago. Don't go anywhere. I'll just find her.
Lawrence turned and plowed into the throng, looking for his girlfriend. Patricia wanted to get out of there, but she felt like she'd promised Lawrence she wouldn't leave this spot. She was bound to this place, as sure as if she'd been imprisoned inside a rock. Minutes passed, and Lawrence didn't come back, and Patricia got more antsy. Why had she thought it would be a good idea to say hi to Lawrence? It just brought up a lot of weird, painful memories of puberty and nearly losing herself. And it wasn't like she needed more awkwardness in her life right now. She'd been feeling invincible, partly because she had just saved this UFO party. But now she felt sour, maybe even depressed. Patricia wasn't naturally manic-depressive, but a big part of the instruction at El Tisley Maze had involved keeping two very different, maybe incompatible, states of mind at once. And in some ways, it was like being taught to be bipolar on purpose. People had a rough time of it, and nobody should be surprised that you wound up with people like Diantha. But Patricia was trying not to think about Diantha. Patricia's mood was crashing fast. Promise or no promise, she had to get out of here.
Hey.
A guy was standing in front of Patricia. He had on a ridiculous waistcoat with purple fleur-de-lis on it, and a watch chain, plus puffy white sleeves. Wide sideburns and shoulder-length dreadlocks framed his face, which had a nice jawline and an easy smile.
You're Patricia, right?
I heard you were indirectly responsible for the amelioration of the atrocious dub thrash music.
I'm Kevin.
He had an accent that she couldn't place, sort of mid-Atlantic, Anglophile. His handshake was soft and encompassing, but not grippy. He was an animal lover, she could tell, who had pets, plural. Kevin and Patricia talked about music and the basic incompatibility between cocktail party and dance party. Because a floor could be a dance floor or a sophisticated mingling with shallow glasses floor, but not both. Floors weren't infinitely subdividable or versatile. Lawrence came back with a cute waifish redhead with a pointy chin, wearing a sparkly scarf.
This is Serafina. She works with emotional robots, Lawrence said.
This is Patricia, he told Serafina, my friend from junior high. She saved my life. Hearing herself described that way made Patricia spit-take her Cosmo. She saved my life. Apparently, that was the anecdote that she'd been boiled down to in Lawrence's mind.
I never thanked you, Lawrence said.
Then Serafina was clasping Patricia's hand delicately and saying it was nice to meet her, and Patricia had to introduce Kevin to both of them. Kevin nodded and smiled. He was taller than Lawrence, and you could have fit two of Serafina inside him. Lawrence gave Patricia his card, and there was vague talk about getting lunch. After Lawrence and Serafina drifted away, Patricia told Kevin, "I didn't really save his life. He was exaggerating." Kevin shrugged, causing his watch chain to jangle.
It's his life. One tends to privilege personal insights in such matters.
A Lexus pulled up in front of Patricia's apartment building just as she was getting her house keys out of her purse. It was 3 in the morning, and somehow Kawashima had known the exact moment that Patricia would get home. As usual, he wore a bespoke dark suit with a thin black tie and a bright red pressed handkerchief, providing one splash of color, even on this hot night. He got out of the car and gave Patricia a cheery smile, like he was pleased they'd happened to run into each other. Kawashima was one of the most powerful magicians Patricia knew, but everyone who met him thought he was a hedge fund manager. His black hair was short, except for one perfect swoosh, and he had the kind of boyish good looks that made people want to trust him, even when he was scamming them out of millions.
"I didn't tell him," Patricia said without bothering to say hi first. "He already knew. He's known since middle school."
Kawashima nodded.
"Sure, but still, talking to civilians about the things we do and how we do them."
He leaned against the car and looked at his unscuffed shoes. Then he looked up at Patricia again, taking her measure.
"What if we told you to kill him?"
"I'd say the same thing I said to that guy 10 years ago, Patricia responded without hesitation. "I'd say no. Actually, I'd say fuck you, followed by no."
"We figured."
Kawashima laughed and clapped his hands a couple times.
"And of course, we would never ask you to do that. Not unless it was absolutely necessary. But we want to meet him. If you trust him, then we trust him too. But we'd like to meet him for ourselves."
"Okay," Patricia said. "We only had one short conversation. But sure, I'll try."
"That's actually not why I came to see you," Kawashima said, "although thanks for bringing it up."
He held up a tablet computer, like a caddy but less fancy, and showed her a map of San Francisco with some places marked with little dots. The North Beach Cafe, with the poet stabbing. The Hayes Valley assault. The junkie. A few other odds and ends. And the party in Twin Peaks.
"You were busy tonight."
"Nobody saw anything." Patricia was burning up. "I was careful."
"This is what you do every night lately. You go out and throw your weight around. For hours. It's great that you want to alleviate suffering. It's praiseworthy. But the world is a balance, much like nature itself. And you have to be careful you don't cause more suffering than you prevent," Kawashima said. "We don't want you to burn out or get carried away. Just remember, aggrandizement comes in many forms."
Patricia wanted to protest. She was being surgical here. She had trained a decade for this. But there was no point. She should be glad she was having this conversation with Kawashima instead of Ernesto.
"You, of all people, should understand the need for great care," Kawashima said, because of course he was going to bring that incident up. It would follow her around for the rest of her life, no matter how much she did to atone.
"Okay," Patricia said. "I'll be more careful." She left it vague, on purpose.
"Good enough," Kawashima said. "Now if you'll excuse me, I have an early morning brunch date with 5 Abercrombie models tomorrow."
He saluted and got into his Lexus, which glided down the hill toward Dolores Park. Patricia watched it shrink into the night and marveled at the internal contradiction of telling someone that the most powerful magicians in town are watching her every move. But she shouldn't get a swelled head. But she was too exhausted to dwell on that, and all of the day's minor miracles were catching up with her at once. She slipped inside the apartment, where her roommates had fallen asleep, watching TV again. She tucked them in.
Chapter 17.
Lawrence first met his girlfriend, Serafina, at a robot fashion show, with robots modeling human clothing and human models wearing robot fashions, like mechanical lingerie. The event happened at a garagey art space somewhere south of Market, with a gunmetal trough full of artisanal vodka. Lawrence had come this close to mistaking Serafina for one of the models. Her cheekbones and oval face, her lustrous skin and shiny red-black hair were that amazing. But he'd realized just in time that she was one of the robot makers instead. Serafina's model was a steel sylph with ball-and-socket joints that let it strike a pose, pivot, talk with its delicate hands. Lawrence had helped to build battle bots in college, but never artificial supermodels, and he'd managed to say something witty enough about the difference between the two that Serafina had friended him on MeU. They met for coffee a few days after that, and the coffee date morphed into a dinner date, and the third time they hung out, it was tacitly a sleepover. Serafina had a toothbrush and condoms in a pouch of her vinyl shoulder bag, which was tweaky from Buck Rogers. Pro tip. Do not think of beady, beady, beady while you're having sex for the first time with the most beautiful woman alive, or you will have some explaining to do, even if your motion, rocking the bed frame, does have a sort of beady, beady rhythm. After that, they hung out every other day, held hands on the street, skipped through traffic, whispered in each other's ears in public, clung together skin to skin every moment in private, swapped jean prints, traded odd little gifts, and wondered how soon was too soon to say, I love you. Lawrence had soon found that letting people know he was part of Milton Dirth's 10% project was a super-fast ticket to getting laid. Among the crowd who worshipped Milton, Lawrence was a rock star. About fucking time, really. And yet there was still no way he was in Serafina's league. She was perfect. He was damaged goods. He never forgot this disparity for a second. About a month after they started dating, Serafina took Lawrence into her sanctum. She had to sign him in, and he had to surrender his ID to the man at the desk, who printed a badge with Lawrence's fresh photo on it. She led him down an elevator, along a sloping hallway, through two keypad-secured doors, and on into the lab. Inside, eyes watched Lawrence from every wall and flat surface. Two of them belonged to bearded humans, who said, yo, and then looked back down at their workstations. But the rest all belonged to robots in various states of assembly. Serafina barely introduced Lawrence to the two humans, but took her time showing him the robots, who were animatronic cartoon characters, or animals, or a few mannequin heads. This is Frank. He laughs a lot. Watch out for Barbara. She flirts, but she's got a mean streak. The robots seemed to like Lawrence, especially Donald, the cactus. By now, they'd been dating 5 months. And lately, every time Serafina looked at her phone while they were hanging out, or stared into space, or bit her thick lower lip in the middle of a conversation, Lawrence braced himself. This was it. She was going to dump him. Then the moment would pass. Lawrence was sure she was just waiting for the right moment, or the ideal pretext. Every time he woke up next to her, he wondered if this was the last time her breath would warm the back of his neck and her breasts would graze either side of his spine. He wasn't going to lose her. He had aced bigger challenges than this. He was going to think of something, take extreme measures, even deploy the nuclear option early if he had to. He was going to find a way to hold on to this amazing girl. Lawrence's face beamed from the front of Anya's caddy as he prepared to jump out of the autocopter, onto the roof deck 172 feet below. That same image of Lawrence would be leering from computers all over town right now, thanks to a big article about him in Computron Newsly,
which had just gone live 20 minutes ago and was now being aggregated and repackaged by every other Silicon Valley outlet. Between Me, You, and Caddies, and all the sci-spec-wearing geeks, Lawrence's shit-eating grin would be on everybody's retinas. The gist of the article was, Lawrence Armstead, Wunderkind. And it was all about his awesome quest to save the world, and how he had harnessed Milton Dirth's unlimited cash to gather the world's smartest people. People like Anya, in fact. The text of the article could be lorem ipsum, as far as Lawrence was concerned. The main point was harnessing the echo chamber in his favor at the exact moment that he was about to abseil down to that roof deck. Milton Dirth's ninth maxim, avoid publicity, except when you can wield it like a sledgehammer. Anya was giggling at the picture of Lawrence in her throaty Midwestern girl voice. God, could they have made your chin look any bigger? It looks like a heel of someone's foot growing out of your face. This picture looks like you got a bad chin implant, shouted Tanea from the pilot seat of the autocopter, where she was wearing big headphones over her afro, along with a pair of aviator goggles. She had her operating delicate machinery frown on her narrow mouth, even as she laughed. A chin plant, Anya laughed, creating unaccustomed dimples in her normally dour face. Actually, it looks like you're overcompensating for being unable to grow a beard by just adding more chin. Shut up, shut up, Lawrence said. I'm a wunderkind, okay? He took a moment to look at the two women, reflected on how lucky he was to have such clever weirdos working with him, and vowed yet again that he wasn't going to let this project fail. He wasn't going to let Milton, or any of them, down. He was going to do better, somehow. Then Lawrence jumped out of the autocopter, trusting the steel cord and pulley mechanism to lower him at a fast, but not too fast, clip. He wanted to land on his feet. For a moment, there was nothing but sky all around him. And then the dog patch was rising up, and the brand new, brutalist tower blocks grew in proportion to the ancient warehouses and docks around them. The air was searing hot, even with the wind. Lawrence's face was on every computer screen in town right now, except the screens of the company whose roof deck Lawrence was dropping onto right now, MatherTech. MatherTech's computer screens were spewing gibberish, thanks to a clownware injection attack that Lawrence had unleashed on the company's servers 10 minutes earlier. From the standpoint of the MatherTech founders and angel investors, here's what happened. They were on their roof deck giving a presentation to a set of VCs in a frantic effort to secure second-round funding for their technology, which wasn't just another app, but rather a way to create stable openings in space-time, with a million possible long-term uses if they could just get some investment. And then, just as their slide presentation was reaching the crucial moment, their screens went staticky and showed the Stars and Snakes logo of the Symbiotic Liberation Army, the world's most obnoxious hacker group, and nothing they could do would get the presentation back. The investors fidgeted and started to badger the gothy waitress from the catering company for more macaroons, and Ernest Mather was tearing his frizzy reddish-brown hair out. And just then, the wunderkind, the guy whose long, corn-fed face had been everywhere today, dropped out of the sky and handed Ernest Mather a check, already signed by Milton Dirth, for $10 million. "We're not investing," Lawrence told Ernest before the company founder could even count the zeros. "We're buying you out. We want your technology and a few of your people." Ernest wanted time to think it over, but Lawrence told him he had 5 minutes. The angel investors were already badgering him to take the damn money, and the VCs were all too busy me-ewing their videos of Lawrence's descent from the sky to think about making a counteroffer. A few minutes later, Lawrence, or rather Milton, owned this company. Ernest Mather was taking a bottle of Devil's Bargain IPA from the gothy waitress and draining it. Lawrence rolled up next to Ernest and helped himself to the final macaroon.
"Sorry about the theatrics, man," Lawrence said. "We needed your patents. Plus, we couldn't risk having them fall into the wrong hands. You could have the next WMD here, and we're on a tight timetable to save the world before it's too late."
Ernest, still kind of goggle-eyed, said something about the world being a work in progress.
"Milton really thinks we're going to need a new planet. Maybe soon," Lawrence continued. "We've got to get off this rock. All our models suggest a decent likelihood of a catastrophic combination of natural disasters and destructive war within one or two generations. Look at Seoul. Look at Haiti."
Lawrence reached for one of those beers as well. "As far as we know, we're the only intelligent, technological civilization ever to develop in the entire universe. There's complex life all over the place, but we're still basically unique. We have a fucking duty to preserve that, at all costs."
Lawrence started to explain about how he dreamed of nothing since he was a little kid, but leaving this planet. But Ernest had to run to the executive washroom to dry heave. Lawrence squirreled all the signed paperwork into his breast pocket of his nice black suit and then looked up at the gothy waitress for the first time. It was Patricia.
"Whoa," Lawrence said. "What are you doing here?"
He had a panic attack that she was spying on him or stalking him for a second.
"What does it look like?" she said. "I'm waitressing. My roommate Dee Dee hooked me up with this job."
Lawrence looked at her crisp white blouse and black knee-length skirt, silhouetted against the pale blue sky. Her dark hair was pinned back but still caught the bay wind. Her eyes looked leaf green. Her slender lips were pursed.
"Are you serious? I thought you were like..."
He lowered his voice.
"A witch, now. You went to that special school, right?"
"I have other jobs besides this one, sure," Patricia said. "But I don't get paid for those. I need to pay rent in this city, which is a lot, even with two roommates."
"Oh."
Somehow, Lawrence had imagined Patricia just snapping her fingers and causing money to appear, or living rent-free in a fancy Victorian house full of magical objects, like a mirror that tells you what shoes go with your outfit. Not so much slinging macaroons to venture capitalists for minimum wage.
"So did you mean all the stuff you said to this guy?" Patricia said, "about our planet being doomed and the human race being the only part of it worth saving?"
"Well, no. I don't think we're the only thing worth saving." Lawrence felt a weird shame that was the flip side of his cockiness from a moment ago.
"I hope we can save all of it. But I do worry. We may be past the point of no return here, and it just makes sense not to pin all our hopes on just one planet."
"Sure." Patricia had her puffy-sleeved arms folded. "But this planet is not just some rock. It's not just some kind of chrysalis we can shed, either. You know, it's more than that. It's us. And this isn't just our story. As someone who's spoken to lots of other kinds of creatures, I kind of think they might want a vote."
"Yeah."
Lawrence felt like crap. Just at the moment he ought to be feeling bulletproof. This sucked. But as he replayed his conversation with Mather, he could see how it would sound kind of heinous to Patricia.
"Sorry. I didn't mean to suggest that anybody ought to write anything off. Nobody's going to do that."
"Sure. I guess. Some tipsy VCs needed to come up and get their picture taken with Lawrence, who was still wearing his harness over his Armani suit, and get some spring rolls from Patricia. And Lawrence had to go get these papers notarized or spindled
or whatever you did when you bought a company. Plus, Milton kept texting him. He muttered to Patricia that he would see her later, and she barely said, sure, in between pouring drinks and answering nut allergy questions. One day, the singularity would elevate humans to cybernetic superbeings, and maybe then people would say what they meant. Probably not, though. Serafina was late for dinner because her emotional robots had been having a nervous breakdown. All of them. It took me the whole day to figure out what was bothering them. They just kept wigging out and giving us the hairy eyeball. We looked at everything that had changed in the lab, trying to eliminate every possible factor that could have upset them. Like, was the music different? Did we update their code recently? Lawrence didn't rush her. Problem-solving and troubleshooting were a source of pleasure for both of them, and narrating the process was the next best thing to doing it. The same neural pathways lit up when you talked your way through the maze as when you actually solved it. Except this time, you were bathed in the glow of having already unraveled the thing. And yet Lawrence was still uncomfortable. For one thing, because Serafina was late, they were stuck sitting at one of the sidewalk tables at the fancy pizza place, with nothing but a tiny heat lamp and three meatballs to insulate them from the fog until the pizza arrived. For another, he was trying to be a good listener because of his ongoing not getting dumped project. And active listening was hard work. And people were still giving him weird looks a week after the Mather Tech thing. We finally figured out that only one thing had changed, Serafina said. She wore a camisole, but she'd put her bulky jacket back on when they were seated outdoors. The heat lamp made her skin look bronze. Matt just got a caddy, and he'd brought it to the office. As soon as we took the caddy out of Wi-Fi range, the robots calmed down, somewhat. And before you ask, the caddy didn't have any weird apps installed on it. It was fresh from the store. Wi-Fi range. So they were getting something from the caddy on their wireless network that upset them. Lawrence pulled out his own caddy and glanced over it, as if he'd suddenly spot some brand new feature. It still looked like a big guitar pick with a curved bass, covered with aluminum. The caddy was scanning for open networks, the same as always, but it wouldn't link up with other machines on the same network without being instructed to do so. Unless... Here's what I don't get, Lawrence said, bisecting the third meatball so Serafina could have half. The meatball was their only protection against the cold, the last of their dwindling supplies until their pizza arrived. So your emotional robots... They don't have emotions in the way that humans do, right? I mean, no offense. Lawrence was on thin ice here, and not the edge, but in the dead middle of a lake, 100 fragile paces in any direction. The robots simulate emotional responses to some situations, and they try to pick up on what the people around them are feeling, right? You make it sound like we're designing three-dimensional video game avatars. Serafina didn't quite push her chair back, but she did seem a little farther away. I am well aware it's a lot more involved than that, Lawrence said, both because of the uncanny valley and because the physical world is a lot more complicated. But the real point is... How do you ever know your own emotions are spontaneous and genuine, and not just a programmed set of responses? I don't. I wonder about that all the time. Lawrence was conscious that it was probably a bad idea to confess to your girlfriend that you often wondered if your feelings were just an involuntary response. I just wonder, assuming they have some reason for feeling a particular way, and they don't just wake up on the wrong side of the bed. The caddy had to be doing something that resembled an aggressive act, as defined in their response matrices. Right?
Yeah, Serafina said. They reacted as if they were being threatened.
The pizza came at last, just when Lawrence needed something to distract Serafina from what a mansplaining dick he was being, in spite of all his resolutions.
There must be some other explanation, Lawrence said. You're talking about a caddy. It's not a black box.
People have jailbroken and wiped them. They've installed Linux on them and also ported the caddy OS over to cheap imitation tablets from Liberia. This is the most hacked device in history. If there was something weird about it, we'd know by now.
Hey, said Serafina, chewing pizza. Occam's razor isn't just an optional weapon in Street Warrior 5. Already told you, we eliminated all other possibilities.
The harder Lawrence tried not to screw up, the worse he screwed up. He wasn't going to get dumped. That wasn't a possible outcome. He thought about the nuclear option, his grandmother's old ring, squirreled in the back of his sock drawer. He imagined getting on his knee and presenting it to Serafina. He could picture how it would look riding up her finger past the knuckle, the wrought silver wrapped around the gemstone, the look on her face as she blushed down at him. After dinner, they went for drinks and wound up in the Latin American club, right under the mannequin with the merkin.
Oh, look, Serafina said. It's your friend.
He followed her line of sight and spotted Patricia with an African-American guy in a black velvet coat covered with elaborate piping. After a moment, Lawrence recognized the dude she'd been talking to at Rod Birch's house. Patricia waved at them, and they waved back. Lawrence didn't know whether he and Serafina ought to be intruding on Patricia's date or whether he wanted her intruding on theirs, and he worried Patricia was going to lecture him about the planet again. But Patricia beckoned them over, and Serafina went. Patricia's date was named Kevin, and he was a Monty Python-quoting Anglophile who walked dogs and worked in a cafe. But his real job was creating a web comic, which Lawrence had read a few times. The secret to a successful webcomic is to trick people into believing they will only get all the jokes if they read regularly. By the time they realize there are no jokes for them to get, they've invested too much time to quit, and they can't admit they've been duped, said Kevin. There's a whole art to creating non-existent jokes that appear to go over everyone's head. It's much harder than creating actual jokes.
The comics I read were funny in their own right, said Lawrence, so you totally screwed up.
You are destroying me, said Kevin. Patricia was telling Serafina that she'd just quit a terrible catering gig, but now she'd gotten a new job at one of the fancy mission bakeries where they were using locally sourced organic grains, not just to be fancy, but out of necessity, since the great Midwestern dust bath.
I love to bake, so this is perfect.
Serafina liked baking too, but she was lousy at it.
I made this cake once and it caved in, and I thought my kid brother had stepped on it in the oven. I beat him up for like an hour before I realized I just forgot to put in enough of that stuff.
You mean flour? Patricia said.
Yeah, flour.
Serafina smiled. There was a long silence. Kevin cleared his throat like he was going to say something clever, but then he thought better of it. Lawrence still itched all over, thinking about how he'd tried to lecture Serafina about her job at dinner, and now she was forced to hang out with his middle school friend. He needed a patch for this date. Not to mention, he felt some random need to prove to Patricia that he wasn't a total jerkface. While they waited for drinks, Lawrence tried telling Patricia all about Serafina's emotional robots, then realized halfway through that talking about Serafina in the third person didn't make her seem cool, but just made it seem like Lawrence thought she couldn't speak for herself. Patricia seemed cool, Serafina said afterward, as she and Lawrence sat in Humphrey Slocum and shared some secret breakfast, that weird ice cream with the cornflakes and whiskey in it. You didn't really get to see what's cool about her. Lawrence scooped some ice cream. Obviously I did, since I already said I thought she was cool. It's weird to see someone you haven't seen in 10 years, and it brings back all sorts of stuff. I was such a loser, you wouldn't believe. When talking about middle school, Lawrence had long since learned it was best not even to mention that he believed he'd created artificial intelligence in his bedroom closet, even as a funny story. It just made him sound like an asshat. They finished their ice cream. Which ice cream with whiskey in it might not have been the best idea after 3 beers at the Latin American. Lawrence was seeing a lot of floaters, and his head was only getting fuzzier. Plus, he felt a deep unrest in the pit of his stomach. So, what's going on? Serafina said. I feel like there was some subtext to this evening that I missed. Lawrence thought of saying that he didn't know whether subtext was an emotional state or a mental state, or even what the exact difference between the two things might be. But he bit his tongue and said, I feel as though I'm on probation. I mean, in this relationship. Huh. News to me. Serafina shrugged. Her eyes widened and her lower lip curled inward as she looked at her boyfriend. Her red highlights glistened under the fluorescent hipster ice cream store lights. She looked so beautiful and so filled with curiosity. Lawrence felt a brand new pang of love for her. He was ready to open himself up to her, something that didn't come naturally to him. Her calloused and manicured fingers toyed with the unladen ice cream spoon. Have I said or done anything to give you the idea that you're on probation? She asked. Lawrence searched his memory for a moment, then shook his head.
I guess I just decided I was. I don't know why.
This is weirding me out. I mean, I feel like our communication has sucked for, I don't know, a month or so. But maybe it was worse than I knew. Serafina massaged her own temples, pinching the skin on either side of her eyebrows.
So, I'm not on probation then?
Well, Serafina stopped mortar and pestling her forehead and looked him in the eye. I guess you are now.
Oh. Well played, Armstead.
Chapter 18. Patricia couldn't get that image out of her head. Lawrence dropping out of the sky and waving money around, boasting that he would save the world by writing off the planet. Even if she hadn't seen it with her own eyes, the video clip was all over the net afterward. Patricia shouldn't be surprised that Lawrence had turned into an entitled yuppie. This was what he'd always wanted, wasn't it? To be admired, to have everybody get his name right. Patricia kept feeling annoyed, until she realized, maybe, she was jealous. She spent so much energy keeping her good deeds secret, it was hard to watch someone else show off. Lately, the other witches were always on her case about aggrandizement, no matter how hard she tried to be humble. Patricia found herself still obsessing about Lawrence as she slid on knee-high leather boots in a black baby doll dress with red sparkles and went to an Irish bar in the financial district to put a curse on someone. Patricia sucked at walking in spike heels and kept almost wiping out as she strode inside the stuffy, blaring pub and tried to recognize Garrett Borg from the picture Kawashima had emailed her. In person, Garrett looked like a once-hot alpine ski instructor gone to seed, with very fair hair and a blue double-breasted suit that camouflaged his pudge. He was halfway passed out at the bar, drooling into the Guinness towel, but still raising his head to pour more high-end scotch into his mouth with his free hand every few moments. In theory, Patricia shouldn't need to know why she was hitting this guy. Kawashima had ordered it, and that ought to be enough for her. But Kawashima had included some other pictures along with Garrett's headshot. The coroner's photos of the teenage girls he'd left buried in an old culvert along the I-90, nearly matching bruise marks on their necks and inner thighs. So Patricia was properly motivated when she slid onto the leather-top stool next to Garrett and whispered in his ear,
"I bet you'll have one hell of a hangover tomorrow. But you know what? I know the best hangover remedy there is. This shit will cure anything."
She made it sound miraculous, but also sexy and illicit. He popped both the pills she gave him without hesitation. Then she helped him into a cab, and he went home to Pacific Heights to sleep it off. She hadn't lied. The shit she'd given him would indeed cure anything. There was zero chance that Patricia would sleep after putting a curse on someone, but she would be careful and would follow Kawashima's advice to avoid overreaching. She knew why they were so worried about her going off the rails. She could still see Toby's corpse when she closed her eyes, the janky expression, like Toby was about to sit up and tell a dirty joke. Patricia had to crouch down to talk to a confused marmalade cat who needed help finding his way home. He remembered what his house looked like on the inside, but not on the outside. Patricia checked on Jake, the crocodile junkie, who seemed stable now, give or take, and then she cruised the St. Mary's emergency room, looking for people to heal on the down low. She spent a couple hours trying to compose a letter to the Parks Department on behalf of some gophers whose burrow was being disturbed, pointlessly, by some inept landscaping in Golden Gate Park. It took a lot of concentration to translate from gopher language into bureaucratese. Right about now, Garrett Borg would be evaporating into a whiskey-scented cloud over his heart-shaped bed. Patricia ended up at the edge of the park on Fulton, staring at the warm dirt, so full of life, between her pointy toes. She wasn't pacing herself, after all. She dug in her bag for her phone and peered at the screen. There was nobody for her to call at 3 in the morning. Even at 3 in the afternoon, there would have been nobody to call. Maybe Kevin, her ambiguous friend with benefits / boyfriend. She was trying not to crowd him. The traffic light at the edge of her vision changed primary colors. It was another hot, itchy night. An owl landed on a branch nearby, without a sound. "Hello," Patricia said. The owl blinked at the sound of her voice.
"If I can see you, so can others,"
the owl said. "I'm not trying to hide, exactly," Patricia said. The owl shrugged with its whole body, like it was Patricia's funeral, then flew off again because there were some gophers with an imperfect burrow not far away. Just as Patricia was rallying to pull her butt out of the dirt and go home, someone sat on the low stone wall and blocked her view of the street. A man. She almost hid, but decided not to bother. It was Lawrence, and he was crying into a napkin with a picture of a woman inside a cocktail glass. Patricia almost walked away. Lawrence would never even know she'd been there, until her healer instinct kicked in. Patricia made as much noise as possible coming up behind Lawrence so as not to sneak up on him, but he still jumped off the wall so hard he fell and skinned one knee. Patricia helped him up and braced him, then steered him back to the wall where he'd been sitting.
"Oh, hey," Lawrence said, making sense of her features. "It's you."
This was the first time she'd seen the grown-up Lawrence act anything but cocky. Hunched over, flushed, he looked more like the Lawrence she remembered. "Is everything okay?" she asked.
"Yeah, I just went for drinks with my co-workers, and I'm kind of maudlin drunk." He paused. But also, I feel like I'm screwing up everything. I'm losing my girlfriend, Serafina. You met her. She's amazing. And meanwhile, I have all these people expecting me to work miracles, and I can only accomplish so much with asinine stunts like the one you witnessed. My boss, Milton, is counting on me. My super smart team is counting on me. But most of all, I made a promise to myself. I always thought that if I just had the chance, I could change everything. And it turns out that maybe I'm just not good enough. So I resort to trying to trick people into thinking I'm a wunderkind, to make up for the fact that I can't actually figure out anything. Jesus. Patricia climbed up the slope and over the wall Lawrence was sitting on. She had a flashback of the teenage Lawrence telling her that the power to make everyone see an illusory version of yourself would royally suck. Lawrence scooted over to give Patricia more room on his chunk of wall. And I was just thinking about my parents. I looked down on them for so long for being failures. I was kind of horrible to them. And I was just thinking that maybe one day I would understand why they chose to fail. But it would be too late. Or a realization I'd rather not have. My life plan involves never understanding my parents, Patricia said. That's like the cornerstone. You met them. You saw what they were like. I'm dedicated to not being the person they wanted to make me. Yes. Lawrence laughed, a queasy drunk laugh, but still a laugh. You know, no matter what you do, people are going to expect you to be someone you're not. But if you're clever and lucky and work your butt off, then you get to be surrounded by people who expect you to be the person you wish you were. Huh. I hadn't thought of it like that. How about you? Lawrence stood up and got oriented, only swaying a tad. What are you doing out on your own at this hour on a school night?
Working. Patricia stood up, too. She was going to get Lawrence home in one piece and then crash.
I work long hours.
You work alone? Lawrence said.
They straggled down the hill toward the Hate, where there would be taxis cruising for kids leaving the latest Soul Relief fundraiser.
I do everything alone, Patricia said. I went to this small, claustrophobic school called El Tisley Maze, so I'm still kind of enjoying going solo in a big city where nobody knows who I am, you know? I feel like that's what being a grown-up ought to be like. She got them a cab, which dropped Lawrence off first. Lawrence shoved a 20 at Patricia on his way out the car door and tripped over his seatbelt. She watched him attack his front steps with his shins and felt something like protectiveness. She made the cab wait until he got inside his house. The whole drive to Sacramento, the other witches found ways to lecture Patricia about aggrandizement. She sat in the back of Kawashima's Lexus, watching the highway whip past as Kawashima hectored her about making herself too important and using her power too recklessly. Dorothea chimed in every now and then with one of her jarring untruths like, "You threw pebbles at my window, but they turned into grenades in midair." Dorothea was an old Catholic lady with white-streaked black hair, chunky glasses, and long calico skirts who never, ever told the truth, except maybe in confessional. By the time they arrived, Patricia felt like a monster, and she kept picturing Toby's frostbitten body lying in the airship. The others were doing important witch business in Sacramento, so Patricia had time to wander around in the scorching midday sun and read on her phone about the French blight, the chaos on the Korean Peninsula, the new, deadlier Atlantic superstorms. All things she could do nothing about. Then her peripheral vision landed on a homeless man on the sidewalk. He was staring at her, empty big gulp cup in one hand. She turned and looked him over, his torn muddy coat and soiled track pants, his disease and malnourishment. His cardboard sign was so tattered and faded, nobody could decipher it. He was covered with a layer of grime, but also cobwebs and even moss. Normally, if she was out on her own, at night, in the city, she would heal someone in this condition without a second thought. But Kawashima and Dorothea were nearby, and she never knew what they would consider aggrandizement. They never gave her clear-cut guidelines. She edged a little closer, struggling with herself. This man needed her help. It couldn't be wrong to take the initiative, could it? She looked into his narrow, dark eyes, and she could see his damaged pride, and she reached out. She realized she was looking at the bony, ravaged face of her junior high school guidance counselor, Mr. Rose. She was boiling in her own skin. She nearly threw up.
"Don't worry," Mr. Rose croaked. "I will not try to kill you. I couldn't if I tried. You've grown much too powerful, and the years have ruined me. But you must know, I was doing the right thing. I saw a vision of things to come. Patricia, you will be at the center of so much pain. You will betray, and you will destroy. If you had even any conscience, you would end your own life right now."
For so long, she'd imagined this moment. When she was out until dawn, night after night, she'd been rehearsing for this, facing this bloody sadist, showing him she couldn't be terrorized. But she hadn't expected him to be so helpless, literally showing his belly. She couldn't help feeling sorry for him. She didn't take in what he was saying at first, about how she should kill herself. And then she had to spit on the pavement. "Nice try," she said, but her arms and face burned like the worst poison ivy. "Everything you ever said to me was a lie," she told the huddled old man on the sidewalk. "That's all you do."
"I had assumed a witch with your power levels could tell if I was lying. Please, please listen."
He looked up, and Patricia was startled to see tears all over his filthy cheeks.
"I killed so many people, but I still couldn't stand to look upon what you and your friends are going to bring about. Have they told you about the unraveling yet?"
"The what?" Patricia pulled back. "Forget it. I'm not listening to you anymore."
"You have to listen. Patricia Delphine, I know you better than anyone."
She backed up until she was up against the parking meters, and he rose from his cardboard mat, waving a bandaged finger. He breathed foulness at her.
"I spied on you for months when you were a child. I parked outside your house. I listened to all your conversations night and day. I know everything. I even know about the tree."
"What tree?" Patricia swallowed. "I don't know what you're talking about."
"Ask them about the unraveling. Ask them. See what they tell you." "Oh, fuck me."
Kawashima was approaching from the nearby hardware store, plastic bag swinging from one hand. "You have got to be joking. This asshole again?"
"Theodolphus,"
Dorothea said from behind him, looking at the grimy man. She managed to make just his name into the worst insult. "You know this guy?" Patricia said. Kawashima ignored her and said to Theodolphus,
"You are just the worst, man. You're like a bad rash. I thought we killed you a long time ago." "I have been as good as dead for many years."
Theodolphus rose, drew himself up, as if he was boasting.
"But I needed to warn Miss Delphine here. She was my best student once, when she was a child. I saw a vision of her grown, as she is now, a vision of destruction. I thought she should know."
Let me guess, Kawashima said. You huffed some vapors and hallucinated, right? Visions of the future are always bullshit, and I should know. I'm the biggest bullshit artist around. Dorothea, do you want to do the honors?
Mr. Rose was still thrashing and yelling about his vision of madness and destruction and a hole in the world. But Dorothea came closer and whispered a story about a man she had known. He had been a maker of netsuke, those little carved figurines that Japanese people used as kimono clasps. But he was also a journeyman assassin, and some of his carvings had hidden death traps, little poison needles, reservoirs of toxic smoke. The deadly netsuke were always in the shape of a beautiful woman in a lewd pose, and you could give one to a person knowing he or she would wear it and die. Until one day the man became confused and put a lethal spring-loaded dart into a frog that he had meant to put inside a courtesan. He then sold the frog to one of his favorite clients, who was sure to wear it that evening and who knew nothing of the man's side business as an assassin. How could he warn his customer? At this point in the story, Dorothea's murmurs had gotten so soft that Patricia didn't hear how the story ended, and Theodolphus was no longer in a position to listen either, because somehow, without anybody noticing, he had changed from a person to a tiny wooden figurine, an inch and a half tall. Dorothea picked him up and showed him to Patricia. He was a slender woman lifting her skirt, except that the face was that of a very solemn frog. Dorothea dropped the figurine into Patricia's palm, then closed Patricia's fingers around him for safekeeping.
I can't believe we didn't kill that douchebag a long time ago. Kawashima unlocked the Lexus and got in the driver's seat. Seriously, such a dick.
Dorothea nodded and rolled her eyes. On the drive back to San Francisco, Patricia tried to ask Kawashima about the thing Theodolphus had mentioned, the unraveling. But of course, that sort of question was the worst possible aggrandizement. Patricia dozed, and in her dream she tried to figure out how Dorothea's story ended. Then the answer came to her. The netsuke maker, assassin, would have to take the frog back from his client, by force if necessary, and would sacrifice his own life in the process. The frog would have to claim someone's life in the end, if not the client, then the man who made it. Patricia felt zero closure from seeing Mr. Rose get what was coming to him. He'd seemed so pathetic, she even had to struggle to avoid feeling guilty, and she couldn't let go of the notion that maybe Mr. Rose was telling the truth, and she was doomed to become a war criminal. Kawashima kept insisting that visions of the future were worse than worthless. But then, with the next breath, he would tell Patricia again that her pride was dangerous. She ended up with an internal monologue that said she was a terrible, destructive person who should watch her every step. Right after she got back from Sacramento, she had to rush to the Tenderloin to look in on Reginald, the AIDS patient she'd been assigned to as a Shanti Project volunteer. As usual, she tidied his apartment, cooked him a healthy breakfast, helped him shop. But then she paused, watching him in his unstained wooden rocking chair, and she thought, this time, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to cure him, because why not? It would be so easy. Except that she knew, for sure, what Kawashima and the others would say about that. You can't just go around curing someone's incurable disease, especially when everybody knows you were there. It would raise too many unanswerable questions, and maybe curing Reginald would be the first step toward her becoming some kind of monster, like Mr. Rose had warned.
I hope it's the good kind of dilemma.
Reginald broke Patricia's reverie.
Whatever one you're on the horns of.
She went over and sat by Reginald, taking his hand. I'm just going to do it.
She always reduced his viral load whenever she visited, anyway. Curing him outright wouldn't be that much more of a big deal, right? Reginald's studio smelled like cannabis and Nag Champa. He had a thin mustache, short gray hair, and Elvis Costello glasses, and his neck had prominent tendons. "I was just thinking," she said. "There are so many crazy problems in the world. Like, I was just reading that we could be seeing the last of the bees in North America soon. And if that happened, food webs would just collapse, and tons more people would starve. But suppose you had the power to change things. You still might not be able to fix anything, because every time you solve a problem, you'd cause another problem. And maybe all these plagues and droughts are nature's way of striking a balance. We humans don't have any natural predators left, so nature has to find other ways to handle us." Reginald had tattoos all over his pale torso, one for each species of insect he had discovered across the Americas. These insect drawings resembled something out of a Victorian naturalist's handbook, with just splashes of color here and there. As Reginald's body had changed, his loose folds of skin and pot belly made it appear as though the locusts and butterflies were flexing their wings and twitching their heads. His pecs were all wasps, his arms sleeved with shiny chitinous beetles. "I am, as you know, a fan of nature," said Reginald. "And yet nature doesn't find ways to do anything. Nature has no opinion, no agenda. Nature provides a playing field, a not particularly level one, on which we compete with all creatures great and small. It's more that nature's playing field is full of traps." In the end, she stopped just short of curing Reginald outright, just like always. Patricia dreamed she got lost in the woods, like she had when she was a girl, stubbing her toes on roots, skidding on dead leaves, feeling transported by the cave-like scent of damp earth, clouds of insects in her eyes and up her nose. She laughed so hard she snorted dead bugs, for joy at being out of the city at last. And then she wandered into a clot of thorn bushes, which tore at her skin and clutched so hard she couldn't go forward or backward without shredding, and her giddiness turned to anxiety. Because what if people needed her help? Or the other witches? What if she was going AWOL right when someone was in trouble? The more she tried to force her way out of the bracken, the harder it tore at her, until she realized that this was her dream, and she could always fly in dreams. She lifted up out of the thicket and flew up along a steep incline that was studded with roots. And then it came into view, huge and dark, like a raven formed of branches and leaves, a huge ancient tree, filled with patience and enough memories for a billion rings, twin branches undulating as in greeting. "So what was the thing you couldn't tell me about over the phone?" Lawrence asked as he brought their espressos from the counter. In response, Patricia just pulled the tiny wooden figurine out of her bag and told Lawrence who it was. Mr. Rose stared up at them, wide-eyed frog face looking prayerful one moment, whimsical the next. "This is him? This is the actual person?" Lawrence kept holding it up to the light, like he was trying to see some resemblance. "He's so tiny." "Yeah," Patricia said. "I have no idea what to do with him." Lawrence and Patricia were in the Circle of Trust, which had been the trendy coffee shop in the Valencia Street corridor about 18 months earlier. It still had all of the nice wooden fixtures and the super expensive espresso machines, but it was half empty, because all the best people had already moved on to the new place, a block away. The Circle of Trust was having an art show featuring finger paintings done by a 28-year-old woman with subversively naive word balloons. The coffee was super pricey, with all the shortages,
but they still went Dutch.
Seeing him so helpless and watching him get transformed into this tiny object, it doesn't change my memories of how huge and terrible he was, Patricia said. It's like two different people. And it sounds like he spent a lot of the last several years being a thorn in the side of the other witches, because he went crazy and had some kind of apocalyptic vision. That's why he was at our school in the first place, because he thought I would grow up to become a monster.
Huh. Lawrence stared at the figurine. Patricia felt self-conscious about how borderline obscene the raised skirts were, how weird this was in general.
But you didn't. Grow up to become a monster, I mean.
And come on, did he ever tell anyone the truth? About anything?
No, Patricia said. She took the figurine and slipped it back into her purse. She was going to beg Kawashima to take Mr. Rose off her hands.
No, he didn't.
He was a compulsive liar. Is. Was. Not sure what tense to use.
There could be a better conversation killer than plunking down your most hated childhood authority figure, shrunk to the size of a man's thumb, but Patricia couldn't think of one. The two of them sipped coffee and shook their heads, trapped in recursively horrible memories. Patricia had to fetch water and guzzle it. The cafe's stale air had stayed almost as hot as noon, even as the sun drifted below the skyline. Lawrence was staring at Patricia's purse, where she'd put the figurine away.
I think all the time about how close he came to ruining my life. It's one of the reasons I'm so desperate to succeed, because I almost didn't get this chance.
Abruptly, he stood up. Come on, I want to show you something.
Patricia was struck anew by just how tall he'd gotten. Patricia was tall, too, but she came up to his collarbone, and he had enough nervous energy for 9 ferrets.
Patricia followed Lawrence down to Mission Street, and then around a couple of side streets until they were near Shotwell, on one of those streets that goes for just a block or two. It was another itchy, parched day. Patricia remembered hearing there was a creek here originally, before it was drained or paved over. Sometimes she imagined she could still feel the current of the banished ecosystem. They reached a cement block with nothing to distinguish it from the other blocks. Lawrence pulled out a key, but didn't put it in the lock on the maroon steel door. Instead, he punched a series of 12 numbers into a keypad recessed into the wall, which Patricia hadn't even noticed. And then he turned the key in the lock. 2.5 flights of steps up, there was a door with a bunch of metal studs in it, and a sign that read, Procrastination Solutions. Come back tomorrow. Lawrence knocked 17 times, in a precise sequence of long and short knocks, and the door swung open.
Welcome to the 10% Project, Lawrence said. The local office, anyway.
The space behind the steel door was bigger than you'd expect, and much cooler than the outdoors. A square loft, with an opaque skylight, along one edge of the ceiling. Ergonomic chairs jostled against workbenches, which were stacked with equipment and soldering irons and Arduino boards and laser tools. The centerpiece of the room, though, was a massive piece of equipment, the size of a Buick, culminating in a sort of ray gun nozzle. It was aimed at a white plexiglass circle. Lawrence introduced Patricia, in turn, to the three people in the room. Tanea was an African-American woman wearing a welding mask, tank top, and shorts. Her forearms were strong, but her neck and shoulders were fluid, mercurial. Tanea could build anything, said Lawrence. In fact, she'd found Milton the same way Lawrence had long ago, by figuring out some schematics on the internet. Except that these schematics were ones that nobody else had managed to make work, and they'd led to that oversized ray gun on bent legs. Tanea waved, then went back to shooting sparks in all directions. Anya
was a freckled Midwestern girl whose nut-brown hair had blue tips, like she'd dyed it and then given up. She wore denim overalls and chunky engineer glasses and looked like someone who never smiled. She muttered to Lawrence about giving tours to outsiders. Saugata had a thick black mustache, a Southern California surfer accent, and a Caltech sweatshirt. Lawrence whispered that Saugata had wanted to work in television and had even interned at the Space Above and Beyond reboot, but now he'd fallen back on his second-choice career of saving the world in real life. Patricia wasn't sure if she should ask about the big machine with the giant vacuum-tube-looking body and the pointy nozzle. But then Lawrence started explaining it anyway. "We're working on solving gravity." He examined some readings on the machine. "We don't have true antigrav yet, just a few isolated instances. And antigrav isn't the point. Controlling gravity is. We know that it's a weak force in our universe, which means it's a strong force somewhere else, and we're trying to figure out where or what that is." Wow. Patricia could fly without any fancy ray, of course, but only when the situation warranted, and or when she could trick someone into a bargain that included giving her the power of flight, or in dreams. The idea of turning gravity on or off, or harnessing its power, amazed her. She was going to be late for Kawashima's latest assignment, an oil executive who was partway responsible for the North Sea disaster. But she wanted to admire Lawrence's machine. Lawrence showed her the readouts of just how much energy throughput they had gotten into those sleek tubes without anything blowing up. "That's sure an impressive machine," Patricia said. And yeah, there was something both aesthetically pleasing and satisfying about a great piece of engineering, shiny and sturdy. She felt the same affection for this machine that she did for the old manual typewriters they sold in the hipster gallery on Valencia, or for a nice steam engine. These things were made of hubris, because they always broke down, or worse, broke everything. But maybe Lawrence had been right, and these devices were what made us unique, as humans. We made machines, the way spiders made silk. Staring at the red, wasp-shaped chassis, she thought of how disgusted she had been with Lawrence not long ago. And maybe she shouldn't judge him. Judging was a kind of aggrandizement. And maybe this device was the culmination of everything she'd always admired about him from the start. And yes, a sign that they both won out over the Mr. Roses of the world. "It's beautiful," she said. Chapter 19. Lawrence and Patricia hashed out their respective relationship problems while smoking an elf-shaped bong on the couch. Lawrence info-dumped about Serafina, the ongoing probation, and then he got embarrassed about monologuing and asked Patricia about the guy she'd been drinking with. Kevin, the webcomics guy. Patricia took the bong and filled both lungs before trying to answer. "It's confusing. I'm still not sure if Kevin and I are dating or just booty call friends. Whenever he sleeps over, he tries to steal away in the middle of the night. But nobody can sneak out on me, after all the training I've had. So he winds up either having to say goodbye properly or staying until morning. He's tried both, and neither way quite seems to work for him." "Ah. I keep almost having a conversation with Kevin about what it is we're doing, and then it doesn't materialize." Somehow, seeing the wooden Mr. Rose had been a turning point in Lawrence and Patricia's relationship, not just as a bonding thing, but also as a reminder that they had known each other as total losers in eighth grade. Patricia might be the hardest person for Lawrence to disappoint, because she'd already seen him at his worst.
In fact, this was the most at ease Lawrence had felt in months, and not just because of the elf bong. Nobody talked for a while, until Patricia changed the subject. "So how are your parents? Still wanting you to be outdoorsy?"
"I think they're actually pretty happy," said Lawrence. "They got divorced about 7 years ago, and my mom found a guy who likes to go bird watching. My dad quit his awful job and went back to college to become a high school teacher. I always kind of thought they'd be happier if they split up, even though you never want to root for your parents to do that. How are yours?"
"They're, okay," said Patricia. "They actually disowned me for a few years, but this past year they've made this big effort to reconnect." She sighed and sucked in more smoke from the elf's head, even though her throat was getting scratchy.
"It's all thanks to my sister, sort of. Roberta keeps getting arrested, or winding up in the ER. She was always the one who had it together, of the two of us. Now, all of a sudden, my parents have noticed that I'm holding down a job and don't have a criminal record, and they've decided that I can be the good daughter now. Like, Roberta and I could just trade places. I have no idea how to deal."
Lawrence was going to say something else, but Isabel came home. She was soaked because it was raining, and the experimental self-configuring umbrella had gotten stuck in a non-optimal shape, judging from the complainy servo noises it was making and the fact that the left side of Isabel's cardigan was drenched while the right side was totally dry. She no longer had the long brown braids she'd sported when he'd first met her as a child, and instead wore her graying hair in a bob.
"Oh, dear," Lawrence said. "Lord Umber let you down."
This nickname hadn't caught on with anybody else yet, but he kept trying. Isabel just snorted and threw Lord Umber at the kitchen sink, where he could drain. Lord Umber groaned and attempted to transform into a shape that would protect the sink from any indoor precipitation. He got stuck again, making loud whining noises.
"Not cool," Isabel grimaced. "Not cool at all.
A regular umbrella would have been way better. Oh, hello." She had gotten enough rain out of her eyes to see the unfamiliar young woman seated on the couch.
"Nice to meet you. I'm Isabel."
Patricia said her name and they shook hands. Then Isabel ran off to get out of her half-wet clothes. When she came back, she had a snifter of brandy. She sat on the sofa next to Patricia and started making low-maintenance small talk about all the places around the world that would kill for some of this rain.
"So I think I heard about you," Isabel told Patricia. "You go back almost as far with Lawrence as I do. He seems to collect people for life."
She glanced at Lawrence, who squirmed, as he sensed he was supposed to. They were pretty high up in the hills. Despite its name, most of Noah Valley was a steep hillside. The living room had picture windows facing over the downward slope of garden out front and the tops of trees farther out. Potrero Hill answered the hill they were on, with its own trees and split-level houses. Their front room had high ceilings, and then a spiral staircase led up to the upper level containing Isabel's bedroom, bathroom, and study, with a balcony overlooking the living room. Lawrence's in-law bedroom was down a few steps, over on the other side of the kitchen, with a view of the tiny backyard. The three of them ordered burritos, and judged that the rain had stopped long enough to risk trudging down the hill to pick them up. The evening had turned warm, despite the massive puddles at every street corner and the clouds on the skyline. Lawrence walked between Isabel and Patricia, and was conscious of being hemmed in by women, especially with them talking past him.
"How did you end up having Lawrence as a housemate?" Patricia asked Isabel.
Isabel told the story about Lawrence running off to see the rocket when he was a kid.
"I kind of kept an eye on Lawrence, and when he got done at MIT, I offered him my spare room for a while. Actually, Lawrence is hardly ever home,
This is the first I've seen him in weeks, which can only mean one thing. Red Dwarf Marathon. Lawrence made a big show of rolling his eyes, even though he was kind of in the mood for the long-threatened marathon. For her part, Isabel had just come back from Greenland, where Milton Dirth was building a vault that was supposed to last 10,000 years and would only be opened by solving a math problem. It looks like a bomb shelter, crossed with a caddy store and a high-end funeral parlor. Everything is shiny steel and chrome and marble with glass partitions. "What's in the vault?" Patricia asked. "Seeds? Genetic material?" "Nope," said Isabel. "Milton figures whoever opens it in 5,000 or 10,000 years will have plenty of edible crops, or they won't be around at all. It's all technological and scientific knowledge. Schematics, plans, basically an instruction manual for recreating our level of technology, including some ideas for what to do if there are no fossil fuels and certain other elements are unavailable. He's assuming a roughly early 19th century science level in whoever finds it, which might be a stretch, yes. At least the vault will be easy to find. The one piece of electronics in the whole place will be a vertical beam of light, like a searchlight, going off twice a day for at least 10,000 years. That was one of the hardest parts to create. "It's not a serious project," Lawrence said as they crossed Castro Street. "Milton doesn't think the human race will still be here in 100 years, much less a few thousand. This is just his way of hedging his bets, or assuaging his conscience." "It's gotten me 3 free trips to Greenland," Isabel said. "Honestly, I think Milton's opinions depend on how many interns he's killed today." She half-winked to indicate this was a joke, and Milton killed no interns. During the dinner, Isabel talked more about her career transition from rockets to Milton's 10% project. "I used to dream about rockets." Isabel scooped a corn chip into the communal pico de gallo. "Every single night for months and months, after we pulled the plug on Nimble Aerospace, I had these weird dreams that there was a rocket launch going up any minute, and we'd misplaced the final telemetry. Or we were sending up a rocket, and it looked beautiful and proud shooting up into the air, and then it collided with a jumbo jet. Or worst of all was the dreams where nothing went wrong. Rockets just soared for hours, and I sat on the ground watching with tears in my eyes." "Wow." Lawrence touched Isabel on the wrist. "I had no idea." "So how did you stop dreaming about rockets?" Patricia asked. "I think I just got bored with it," Isabel said. "Boredom is the mind's scar tissue." Lawrence and Serafina went to an organic burger place, locally sourced, etc., and Serafina talked about her emotional robots. "You won't believe the heuristics. They recognize faces, but also they recognize each face's habitual emotional states. They're getting the concept of moods. They are having moods. Moods are weird. It's not just manifesting an emotion, or even sustaining an emotion. It's like a disease state, like the way we say you nurse a grudge." Serafina seemed to be letting go of the idea that Lawrence was on probation. He'd gotten her a nice scarf that matched her outfit by some fluke. He was practicing active listening. They'd had brilliant sunburst-in-your-face sex a few times. Lawrence didn't talk about himself too much. He kept thinking about the nuclear option. He tried to judge when would be the optimal time to unleash it. These things work better if you build up to them, rather than as a desperation play. Lawrence remembered his grandma Jules, one of the last times he saw her alive, slipping the ring box into his ski jacket pocket when nobody else was looking, and whispering in his ear, "Give this to whoever you end up marrying, okay?" And Lawrence, still a little kid, realizing this was a solemn request, whispering back that he would do that.
Lawrence had a conviction in his loins that he deserved to be dumped. Because he took Serafina for granted while he was working 14-hour days on the project, or because she was too excellent for him. But the whole point of being grown up and an uber-hacker is that you don't get what you deserve. You get what you can get. After burgers and shakes, he and Serafina went to see the new Tornado Surfer movie. And Patricia phoned just as they were debating what snacks to get from the concession stand. Patricia asked if this was a bad time, and Lawrence said sort of.
Oh, I can call back, Patricia said.
What was it? Serafina wandered off to look at yogurt-covered pretzels, probably annoyed at him for talking on the phone. Her long fingers lifted the packets of white twists as though plucking flowers. Her nose twitched and she smiled, as if the pretzels had told her a joke.
I will not let you get away, he said to Serafina in his mind.
Just that my friends want to meet you. You know, my special friends. They know I told you my secret, and they want you to come over for dinner or something. Maybe Thursday?
Lawrence said yes right away, whereas if he hadn't been in a hurry to hang up so he could go back to being a decent boyfriend, he would have contemplated the prospect of an evening with Patricia's special friends and maybe invented an excuse.
Who is that? Serafina said.
Lawrence said it was his friend from junior high, the weird one, which put Serafina in a position of being able to say she didn't think Patricia was that weird. The movie sucked. Afterward, Serafina and Lawrence went back to Serafina's place and had the best sex of Lawrence's life thus far, the kind where you bite each other hard enough to leave tooth dents and you keep crashing into each other long after you would have sworn you'd already broken everything. They held each other, both of them vibrating, until Lawrence had to pee. He had to remind himself not to flush after only peeing, because everyone was conserving water. When Lawrence got back to bed, Serafina had fallen into a cold sleep, and her elbow jutted into him. Lawrence didn't look up from his workstation between the movie date and Thursday evening, because the 10% project was in permanent crisis mode, and Milton was blowing up Lawrence's phone 24/7. Milton kept bringing up the idea, or rather the threat, of relocating Lawrence and his team to a secure compound in the boonies so they could work with no distractions. As if Lawrence wasn't already driving himself insane. As if this wasn't already his whole life. Lawrence had just enough time to run home, take a quick shower, and change before he had to be back in the mission to see Patricia. They were meeting at some kind of used bookstore where one of the witches lived. Like he was disabled or homebound or something, so he just spent all day and all night in his tiny bookshop, which Lawrence suspected was illegal. Lawrence was the kind of sleep-deprived where he saw LCD monitor ghosts when he closed his eyes. When he was a couple blocks away from that bookstore, on the corner near the bacon-wrapped sausage cart, Lawrence felt a panic attack starting. He was going to say the wrong thing, and these people would turn him into a knick-knack, like Mr. Rose.
Practice your breathing, Lawrence told himself.
He managed to get some oxygen into his brain, and it was like a temporary workaround for sleep deprivation. He was probably dehydrated, thanks to this crazy heat wave, so he bought some water from the bacon-wrapped sausage guy. Then he made himself walk to the three-story mall with the Spanish-language signs. For Patricia, whom he sensed he really wanted in his life. The mall looked deserted, and there was only one bulb on the ground floor to guide him to the winding staircase that led, past beauty supply stores that looked dead, up to the top floor, where a sign read, "Danger. Bookstore is open." Lawrence hesitated, then pushed open the doorway to Danger Bookstore, with a jangle of chimes. The bookstore was one surprisingly spacious room,
with an ancient rug that looked symmetrical until you noticed that the big wheel of fire and flowers at the center was rolling off to the right. Bookshelves covered the walls and also jutted sideways into the room, and they were divided into categories like Exiles and Stowaways, or Scary Love Stories. The books were about half English, half Spanish. Besides books, every shelf had memorabilia perched on its edge, an ancient ceremonial dagger, a plastic dragon, an assortment of ancient coins, and a whalebone that supposedly came from Queen Victoria's corset. Lawrence didn't get two steps inside danger before someone ran an ultraviolet wand over him to kill most of the bacteria on his skin. Patricia rose from one of the fancy upholstered chairs and hugged him, whispering that Lawrence must not touch Ernesto, the man on the red chaise lounge, the one who never left the bookstore. Ernesto hadn't been out in the sun for decades, but his skin was still a warm brown, and his long, high-cheekboned face had deep wrinkles. His gray hair was in a single braid, and he wore eyeliner, or kohl, around his eyes. He was wearing a crimson smoking jacket and silky blue pajama pants, so his outfit looked quasi-Hefnerian. He greeted Lawrence without rising from his chaise. Everybody was super friendly. Lawrence's first impression wasn't of any one person, but just a gaggle of people all talking at the same time and clustering around him, with Patricia watching from across the room. A short, older lady with wide glasses on a string and black and white hair in an elaborate bun started telling Lawrence about the time her shoe had fallen in love with a sock that was much too big. A tall, handsome Japanese man in a suit with a neat beard asked Lawrence questions about Milton's finances, which he found himself answering without thinking. And a young person of indeterminate gender, with short spiky brown hair and a gray hoodie, wanted to know who Lawrence's favorite superhero was. Ernesto kept quoting the poetry of Daisy Zamora. They all just seemed so nice. Lawrence didn't mind that they were all talking at once and overflowing his buffers. Probably this was because of the magic thing, and he ought to freak out. But he was too tired to make himself worry about things that didn't already worry him on their own. Lawrence was nervous that he smelled like bacon-wrapped sausage fumes. The bookstore had no musty old books smell, and instead it had a nice oaky aroma. Similar to the way Lawrence imagined the whiskey casks would be before you put scotch into them for aging, this was a place where you would age well. There was some debate over whether they would go out for dinner, everybody except Ernesto, that is, or just bring in food. "Maybe we could check out that new hipster tapas place," suggested Patricia. "Tapas?" Dorothea, the elderly lady, clapped her hands, so her bracelets rang. The person of unknown gender, whose name rather unhelpfully was Taylor, said perhaps Lawrence would be more comfortable on neutral ground.
"Yes, yes, you must go," Ernesto said in his gravelly voice with a hint of a Latin accent. "Go. Do not worry about me at all."
In the end, Ernesto insisted so loudly that they simply must leave him behind, everybody wound up offering to stay in with him. Lawrence couldn't help wondering if he'd just witnessed a wizard duel. Somehow, they managed to catch the Korean taco truck driving from one location to another and bought a dozen spicy bulgogi and barbecue tofu tacos while it was stopped at a red light. Lawrence's taco had a lot of cilantro and onions, the way he secretly liked it. His anxiety melted away, and he envied Patricia for having such charming friends. If this had been a gathering of Lawrence's tribe, by now someone would already have tried to prove they were the supreme expert on some topic. There would have been dick measuring. Instead, these people just seemed to accept one another and feed each other tacos. They all got seats on folding chairs, or the handful of actual armchairs in the bookstore. Lawrence wound up sitting between Taylor, the young person of indeterminate gender, and Dorothea, the lady of indeterminate age. Dorothea smiled and leaned over as Lawrence chewed his taco.
I once owned a restaurant that had doorways in a dozen cities around the world, she whispered. Each entrance wore a different menu, advertising a different cuisine, but we had no kitchen, just tables, tablecloths, and chairs. We carried the dishes back and forth between the cities in different lands. So were we a restaurant or a conduit?
Lawrence wasn't sure if she was telling a real story or just taking the piss, or both. He stared, and all at once her face was full of laugh lines. After dinner, Ernesto sauntered to a bookcase labeled Parties That Already Ended, which was mainly histories of various empires. He removed a Decline and Fall with a flourish, and the bookcase swung open, revealing a passageway leading to a secret bar, with a neon fairy on the wall and a sign proclaiming it to be the Green Wing. The Green Wing was another oblong, spacious room like Danger Books, but this one was dominated by a circular wooden bar in the center of the room with a single rack full of absinthe. Art Nouveau maidens and crystal dragons and parchment scripts adorned the bottles, which were every size and shape. A few people wearing corsets and poofy skirts were already drinking at a high table in the far corner, but they all waved at Ernesto. Ernesto climbed inside the bar and started pouring from bottles into shakers. Patricia got next to Lawrence long enough to whisper in his ear that he should be careful with any drink made or touched by Ernesto.
Take small sips, she advised, if you plan on having a brain tomorrow.
None of these people seemed to be super influential, and if they ruled the world, they were doing a good job of hiding it. In fact, every other conversation was about how messed up the world was and how they wished things could be different. Ernesto mixed Lawrence something bright green that captured the neon light, and he caught Patricia's warning gaze before lifting it to his mouth. It smelled so delicious. He had to make a mighty effort to avoid pouring it through his lips. His mouth was full of wonder and joy, and there were so many sharp and sweet and bright flavors that he needed to keep sipping to identify half of them. Lawrence was legless. He stumbled until someone helped him into a brocaded 18th-century chair that he couldn't find his way out of again. He realized that this was a perfect opportunity to ask some questions about magic, since nobody could blame the drunk guy for being nosy, right? He raised his head and looked into the swarm of blurry shapes and lights and strained to form a not-too-rude question. He was unable to find a verb to save his life, or a noun.
It has been a pleasure to meet you, Lawrence,
Ernesto said, pulling a stool close to Lawrence's face so that his eyeliner and unpinned long gray hair were in something like focus. He had lowered his voice to a conversational tone, but it still sounded theatrical, every word enunciated, like a stage actor's diction. Ernesto was close enough for Lawrence to catch the scent of an entire meadow pollinating coming off him. Close enough that if Lawrence toppled forward, he would be touching Patricia's mentor, which Patricia had said would be very bad. Ernesto leaned closer, and Lawrence shrank back.
I must ask you a question or two,
Ernesto said between sips from a martini glass,
about your intentions toward Patricia. She has confided in you, and we approve, because everybody needs a confidant. But you must promise us to tell nobody else about the things she shares with you. Not your lover, Serafina, not your friend, Isabel, and certainly not your patron, Milton. Can you make such a promise?
Lawrence said. Yes. Yes, I can.
Will you humor me and swear to it? That if you break your promise, you will never speak another word again. To anyone.
Ernesto laughed and waved one hand, as if this were a mere formality. But in the background, Lawrence saw Patricia shaking her head, her eyes wide with panic.
Sure, Lawrence said. I promise. And if I ever say anything about magic to anyone, I hope I lose my voice. Forever.
Ernesto shrugged, as if mentioning a minor detail.
Forever, said Lawrence.
There's just one other favor we wanted to ask, said the Japanese guy, Kawashima, coming into focus next to Ernesto. They were almost touching.
We worry a lot about Patricia, you see. She went through a lot when she was younger. First that Theodolphus douchebag, and then later that regrettable business in Siberia.
I hate it when you talk about me in the third person when I'm in the room, Patricia said. Not to mention the way you're railroading my friend here.
We want you to help us look out for her, Kawashima said to Lawrence. We have few rules, but our biggest taboo is against what we call aggrandizement, making yourself into a big deal. So we want you to support her and be her friend in a way that none of us can. And yet also to remind her that she is just a person, just like anyone else, if she gets too high an opinion of herself.
Will you do this for her and for us?
Ernesto said. Lawrence thought for a moment they were going to ask him to agree that his hands would turn into fins if he didn't help keep Patricia's ego under control. But for this promise, just a vague, "I'll do my best," seemed to suffice. Kawashima slapped him on the shoulder, and everybody repeated a few times how nice it had been to meet him. Lawrence felt his gorge rising. Someone guided him to a small toilet in the far corner of the absinthe bar, and he crouched over it for a good 15 minutes until his stomach was empty. Taylor and Patricia took Lawrence for vegan donuts over on Valencia Street. His head was split in half, and he was seeing spots. Taylor whispered something in Lawrence's ear, and he felt a bit more even keel. Plus, coffee and ibuprofen helped, too.
You did good, Taylor told him. You were in the frickin' lion's den. And you were as cool as cream cheese.
It just pisses me off, Patricia said. They think I'm some kind of egomaniac when all I want to do is make croissants and get on with my life. And they can't just ask Lawrence to keep his trap shut without putting a spell on him. The full weight of it hit Lawrence then. They'd put a spell on him. A curse, really. If he spoke a word about magic or magicians to anybody, he would never speak again. He knew in his sore guts that this was a fact. Of course, there was no way to test, except the hard way. He stared at his thumbs, pivoting on the oaken table. What if he had to text people instead of talking to them for the rest of his life?
It's not like that, Taylor said to Patricia. You should be grateful that you have people worrying about you. Ever since you moved here to Succafree, you've been overcompensating. I feel bad about Siberia, too, but we have to move on.
Okay, Lawrence said. So now I am apparently under a...
He looked around the coffee place twice, trying to figure out if anyone was within earshot.
I am going to be facing certain constraints about what I can say to people who weren't in that bookstore tonight. So that means you can explain to me, right? You can tell me how this works. I'm just curious, is all.
Sounds fair.
Taylor handed him a second donut.
Yeah, okay, Patricia said, but not here. Maybe this weekend we can go for a walk in the park. I remember how much you like the outdoors.
Lawrence shuddered, which was probably a sign that he was starting to feel like himself again.
Chapter 20.
Patricia felt jittery about throwing her first ever dinner party, because part of her clung to the fantasy of being someone who gathered cool people around her, a doyenne, someone who held witty salons. She cleaned the apartment for hours, made a playlist, and baked bread and bundt cake. Her roommates, Dee Dee and Racheline, made their famous passive-aggressive lasagna, and Taylor showed up with shiny pants and a bowl of mixed greens. Kevin arrived in a deep cerulean waistcoat that matched the ribbon tying back his dreads, and he had brought weird cheeses. Patricia's bread filled the marigold kitchenette with a yeasty warmth, and she took a deep breath. She was a grown-up. She had this. While Patricia served the salad, Kevin told Dee Dee and Racheline about the psychology of dog walking. Some of the times Kevin had tried to sneak out after sleeping with Patricia, he'd run into her roommates still half awake on the couch. They'd started calling him Mr. No Overnight, although not to his face. Dee Dee was talking about her ska band's latest gig, in which, as usual, the blue-haired, wiry singer exuded so much raw Kathleen Hanna-esque sexuality, nobody would ever guess that she identified as asexual. Just as Patricia was fetching the bread, Taylor glanced around and said this was a nice apartment. Too bad Patricia might have to move to Portland soon.
What?
Patricia dropped her mitt on the floor. She was standing by the open oven, so she felt frozen on one side and red-hot on the other.
Oh. Taylor leaned back, hands raised. I thought you knew. They're thinking of sending you to Portland.
Who is they?
Kevin blinked.
Forget I said anything. I was talking out of school.
Taylor's smile had vanished, replaced with wide eyes and a clenched jaw. This was so like Taylor. They were so closed off, you could barely tell what they were thinking most of the time. But then they would toss out these bombs just to see everyone jump. Patricia seized the bread with her bare hands, let it burn her.
This is bullshit. They can't make me move to Portland.
In Portland, all the young witches lived in one group house, with a curfew, and a few older witches supervised them.
When were you going to tell me you were moving to Portland?
Kevin said.
I'm not, Patricia said, choking and coughing. Who's making you move?
Dee Dee asked from the sofa, pierced eyebrows raised.
I don't get it.
Please forget I said anything.
Taylor was squirming now. Let's just eat. Everybody stared at their plates and each other, but nobody said anything, until Racheline broke the silence.
Actually, I think you had better explain, said Racheline, who was older than everyone else and the master tenant on the apartment. Who are these people, and why are they forcing Patricia to move?
Racheline was a quiet woman, a perennial grad student with wild red hair and a placid round face, but when she decided to assert herself, everybody snapped to attention. Everybody stared at Taylor, including Patricia.
I'm not allowed to say, Taylor stammered. Let's just say Patricia and I both have the same caseworker, and everybody worries about her. Like, she goes off on her own for days. She tries to take everything on herself, and she doesn't let anyone help her. She needs to let other people in.
I let people in.
Patricia felt bloodless. Her ears were ringing.
Right now, this moment, I am interacting with people.
She should have known.
It's true, though,
Dee Dee said.
Patricia, we never see you. You live here, but you're never home. You never want to tell us anything about your life. You've been here nearly a year, but I feel like I don't know you at all.
Patricia tried to catch Kevin's eye, but it was like lassoing a hummingbird. She was still holding the bread, and it was burning her hands.
I'm really trying. Look at me trying right this moment. I'm having a party.
She heard her timbre rising until she sounded like her mother.
Red haze blinding her. Why did you have to ruin this for me?
She threw chunks of bread at Taylor, who covered their face.
Do you want some bread? Do you want some bread? Have some fucking bread!
Now she sounded exactly like her mom. She threw away the rest of the bread and bailed out of there, crying and spitting on the dry sidewalk. Patricia had fallen in